Dr. Scott Ray is a professor of philosophy of religion and ethics at Biola University in Southern California, where he teaches and researches in the field of both medical ethics and business ethics. His work extends beyond academia into ethical consulting for four Southern California hospitals, and he's a fellow of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. I caught up with him in Melbourne, where he was a keynote speaker at the Religion in the Public Square colloquium put on by the Presbyterian Church of Victoria. Scott Ray, welcome to Australia.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Do you agree with the claim that bioethics is having to play catch up with technology? It's like we find these amazing things to do, and then it's only later that we start to think about the ethical implications.
I think generally that's true. Historically, it's been more the case, I think, than it is today. A good example of that playing catch up is the role of the ethical, legal, and social implications of the Human Genome Project, which was launched at the very same time that the Genome Project in general was launched, and took about 5 to 10% of their budget. So I think it's the time gap is shortening, but there's probably still a bit of a lag.
The other driver in bioethics seems to be our anthropology, our view of human nature. What do you think is the driving anthropology in Western medicine today?
Materialistic naturalism is what it is, that a human person is nothing more than the coalescence of their different parts and properties, that we are nothing more than the physical stuff of which we are made. That is the overwhelmingly dominant view of a person in the bioethics community.
And what are the implications of that as you see them playing out, the manifestation of it?
Well, the biggest manifestation is that a human person then becomes defined based on what they can do or how they can function, as opposed to what they intrinsically are. In my view, this is a confusion of categories, because from a distinctly Christian view of the world, a human person is something that we are, not something that we do.
Right.
And I think the culture has gotten that reversed.
Do people who hold that more naturalistic view, do they articulate it in that way, that people are valuable according to what they can do?
Not quite in that way, but they will say that there are certain thresholds of function that you have to reach before you can become before you can be designated as a person with all the corresponding rights. For example, a human fetus has to be able to have a certain set of non-negotiable functions that form that threshold. So things like self-consciousness, self-awareness, awareness of the environment, capacity for relationships, all those things are non-negotiable thresholds.
So you would say that it's not good news to be thought of as valuable according to your function?
Definitely not. Because where this cashes out is that it essentially puts the idea of being of what constitutes a person on something akin to a bell curve of those functions. The more you adopt those functions, the more you get the designation. And conversely, you know, for those of us that are on the reverse side of that bell curve, that's not good news for those at the margins on either side. It's not a coincidence that our, in my view, a coarsening of life at the margins has accompanied that view of what a human person is.
As a Christian, in what way is your anthropology different from what you've just described?
As a Christian, human beings have an essential nature that is constituted by virtue of being made in the image of God. It's also constituted by virtue of having souls. A human person has an immaterial component. We are more than just the stuff, the biological, physical stuff of which we are made. And a Christian anthropology affirms that very strongly.
Those with a naturalist framework still claim to, or at least look for, a strong basis of morality. But you have your doubts about that, don't you?
I certainly wouldn't want to say that a naturalist is necessarily amoral, because that's not fair. I do think it's fair to say that a philosophical naturalism has an inadequately grounded view of morality. And typically that's done on an evolutionary scale, that you know, we develop these moral attributes and moral virtues on an evolutionary basis because they contribute to our survival.
That's a bit reductionist, isn't it?
It's extremely reductionist, and it's also pretty difficult to make sense out of some of our most widely held virtues, like altruism and compassion, on an evolutionary basis.
How then do believers and non-believers communicate effectively on these issues if their basis for what they believe is so different?
They are metaphysical disputes. And the bioethics community has not done a particularly good job of, you know, airing their metaphysical dirty laundry, so to speak. It's widely assumed in the bioethics community that either you're a naturalist or you're not really a part of the community, unless you're a designated religious person, and then you're trying to break into the club, essentially.
Some of the issues in ethics to do with, especially I think of reproductive medicine, are so complex and technical. I wonder, how does the average person on the street get good advice in terms of informing their ethics on these issues?
Slowly and carefully. Because, you know, let's put it this way, for the average person who thinks about morality in largely black and white terms, you need to get over that before you start venturing down this road. Not to say that there aren't some things that are black and white, but, you know, these are really difficult areas. Even things that look sort of innocuous, like artificial insemination, you know, where you have the husband's sperm just getting a little turbocharge into the wife's womb, that today has become really complicated, because frequently, to increase the chances of pregnancy, the woman will be given these multiple ovulation fertility drugs that are normally used with in vitro fertilization. And because they want to save money and not go all the way with IVF, they'll do the first part, then do artificial insemination. She may release 5, 10, 15 eggs, and he's putting a couple million sperm in there, and next thing you know, she's carrying a litter of children.
Right, so you're left with these unintended and then quite morally complex situations.
And then the couple is faced with having to selectively reduce pregnancies, which we don't ever encourage people to do. But those are, you know, those are tough situations.
We need good conversations, don't we, rather than people ranting on one side or the other.
Well, yes, and I think that, you know, we need a conversation with the infertility industry. And at least in some parts of the world, the industry is becoming more sensitive to people who have some of these moral convictions.
One of our TV shows recently ran a comical segment on compulsory introduction of euthanasia for people who are over 80. Now, it was a joke, but I wonder, is there a serious side to this? Is this something people should be nervous about?
Usually when something is caricatured like that, the reason it's so funny is because it has a kernel of truth to it. Thankfully, I'm not approaching 80, but I think there are reasons probably to be a little bit nervous, to be a little more sophisticated about it. There's a demographic tidal wave coming in a lot of the Western world. And the American Medicare system has already said they're going to be bankrupt in roughly the next 15 years, which is about the time I'll be eligible for it. A well-known American bioethicist has said there's nothing cheaper than dead. I think, you know, there's a huge public relations thing to overcome, but it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see something akin to that as, you know, part of the solution.
An issue like abortion, it's such a hot political issue, especially in your country, more so than in ours. But I wonder, how do we get into a productive conversation on this without it becoming derailed by political issues?
I think for one is to keep it at the level of morality and not about the level of the law. I think what the law allows is a slightly different discussion than what the demands of morality are. And I'm particularly really troubled by the direction I see the abortion debate going. And that is increasingly the pro-choice, what I'll call the pro-choice position, is conceding that the unborn is a full person. And technologically, I think they're probably it's in their interest to do that, because technologically, the idea that a fetus is simply a piece of tissue or a product of conception is getting harder and harder to hold on to. And intuitively, I think a couple that looks at their, you know, 4D ultrasound, which is just, you know, like right up here in the baby's face, intuitively, they have a good sense that there's something, you know, there's something very special about what's going on in the womb. Once you concede, however, that you have a person, it seems to me that the debate is virtually over on moral grounds. Because if I had a 2-year-old child and did the kind of things that would be negligence and child endangerment, those kinds of things, I would be prosecuted under the law because my 2-year-old child has a claim on me and my resources as the parent for the things they need to flourish. And if that's true of my 2-year-old child and the fetus is already conceded to be a person, then it seems to me the conclusion is that the fetus actually has a claim on the mother's body for all the resources it needs to thrive and flourish.
One of your areas of interest is surrogacy. Now, I wondered, why is that becoming such an important issue today? And are there ever times where you would think surrogacy is okay?
It was very, very hot about 20 years ago. And it's becoming very hot again because now we are outsourcing surrogacy. And so there's new questions about exploitation and coercion and, you know, using money as an incentive to coerce women to do things that they would never otherwise ordinarily do. I have a huge interest in this because it's the commercialization of procreation. I think in many cases it does involve the purchase and sale of children, which I think is not only immoral but also should be illegal. There are a couple of instances when I think it would be okay. I had a couple in my office a while back. They'd been trying for 6 years to have children, conceived triplets through in vitro fertilization. Halfway through the pregnancy, she miscarried all three of them, had a massive uterine hemorrhage, nearly died, they had five embryos left in storage, and they desperately wanted to have a child. They were philosophically opposed to discarding embryos, and so they asked, would it be acceptable to hire a surrogate to gestate their children? And I think in that case, since the other alternatives were discarding the embryos, which was unacceptable, donating them to another couple, which seemed pointless since they wanted to raise the children themselves, or hiring a surrogate, the surrogate, I think, was at the top of the list.
You have said that self-autonomy is the driving force behind a lot of what we get in medical ethics today. But I wonder, what does Christianity have to offer that's different from self-autonomy as the greatest good?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked. There are two things I think Christianity has to offer to this. One is the idea that the satisfaction of desire is a relatively low priority in a Christian view of the world. And the Bible's really clear about that, about, you know, delaying gratification and denying yourself, taking up your cross and following Jesus. I think what that means is that the culture's emphasis on I want it all and I want it now takes a relatively low place in the priority. The other thing Christianity has to offer, it seems to me, is a nuanced view of autonomy that's really helpful, because human beings obviously are not absolutely autonomous, since we live our lives under the authority of Scripture and under the sovereignty of God. And so it really helps keep autonomy from becoming the absolute that it has in the culture today. I think with very, very damaging effects in the culture, seeing autonomy run amok. And I think Christianity helps keep it from running amok.
Scott Ray, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.